Amen. Well, good morning. It is great to see you guys this morning. On the Switzerland trip, if it's something that you're actually thinking about doing, like you're like, yeah, maybe we can do that, I would encourage you to sign up quickly. I think we had like 8 open spots left as of like last Wednesday. So we had like a big rush and then it kind of slows down at the end. So there are still some spots open and we would love to have you. You know, as Charlie said, there's going to be amazing teaching by Dr. Gage. He's incredible. Like you have access to this incredible scholar. I mean, like, you know, you can't follow him back to his room. You got to let him go at some point. But like all the rest of the day, he is yours to answer all your Bible questions. And we've been planning out what we're going to be teaching on. So it's going to be fun. And I think in addition to the beauty and the Reformation and all of that, the friendships you make on these trips are really the walk away. Like that, it's the people in the end where you go, wow, because you have this really formative experience. And then it's like you're friends for life. So there you go. If you're looking for those kinds of relationships, that's a way to pursue that. All right, well, we are continuing today with our study of the life of Joseph, which is kind of opportune for us in light of all of the chaos in the world at the moment, because there was a lot of chaos in this guy's life, and we've been seeing that. And one of the things that I've gotten up and said at the beginning of every message, and I'm going to do it again now, so you're welcome, is I've talked about jigsaw puzzles. And the reason for that is because I think a jigsaw puzzle is a really profound illustration of the way that God interacts with this world and with each one of our individual lives. In other words, the Bible, and particularly the life of Joseph, makes it crystal clear that God did not create the heavens and the earth and everything and everyone in them, including all of us, like a bunch of disconnected puzzle pieces to a puzzle picture that doesn't even exist. So if you try to put the pieces together, they don't fit. If you try to create some kind of a picture out of it, there's no picture to be created. And then he just took us all and threw us out into the universe and said, I don't know, let's kick back, you know, we'll sort of like a soap opera. We'll just sit up here and see what happens. Instead, our God who designs everything started with the picture in mind. Then he created all the pieces, including me and including you, which, by the way, gives a lot of dignity to every one of our lives. You might look at your life and go, good grief, what do we even do with this? Like, how can this be a part of anything? How can this even matter? And God's like, oh, you know, the puzzle is not complete without you, without your life. So here's the deal. You know, I've said that every week, and every week I've also said we're all kind of good with that. You know, we hear that concept, we understand it conceptually, we've done or at least watched other people do jigsaw puzzles. We're like, yeah, I think I get what you're saying. So we're fine with it as long as from our perspective life is going okay, or even if it's just kind of eh. You know, like how you doing? Eh. Yeah, but you're not questioning God when it's eh. You're questioning God when the wheels, again, just from your perspective, come off the proverbial bus. At that point, we're like, whoa, 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 hang on a second. And we question God and we question his goodness and we question, how could he possibly be putting together any kind of a picture that could even resemble anything beautiful with my ugly little puzzle piece as a part of it? And look, I affirm that emotionally. I've experienced that emotionally. But rationally, it makes no sense at all. Like when we step back and just coolly consider it logically, you realize, no, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, that can't be. That just doesn't work. And that's where this illustration, at least in part, is super helpful. Because really, if you think about it, looking at your little life and all you can see, which is what's inside the edges, and then questioning God's goodness and his faithfulness and his existence and his picture and whether it's beautiful and all of these things, including his wisdom and plans and purposes, based solely on what you can see inside of your puzzle piece life, is like reaching into a box of puzzle pieces that form a 500 trillion piece puzzle, just pulling one piece out, not seeing the box top, not knowing what the picture is, not seeing any of the other puzzle pieces and how they all interrelate, and then stepping out into the hallway, if you will, and looking at it and going, yeah, I think I understand this. I know what this is. I can explain this. In fact, I can tell you everything that must be going around this. In fact, I think I can probably describe the whole picture to you. No, you can't. And yet that's what we do, isn't it? We're like, oh my goodness, it's a disaster. Oh my goodness, it's a mess. Oh my goodness, it's devastating. Oh my goodness, it's fill in the blank. So Lord, what the heck, you know, like, what am I to make with this? And as we've said repeatedly, listen, God doesn't show up in those moments where we feel like that, understandably, by the way. and say, hey, bring the puzzle piece over here. I'm going to plug it into this, at least this part of the picture. And, you know, you'll see what's happening around it. That'll be enough for you. And you'll be okay. Like, you'll understand it. You'll be fine. This will be satisfying to you. Just hang in there. You're going to be okay. He doesn't do that. And even if he did do that, we wouldn't understand it. Like, we don't have the capacities to understand that our lives are generational in their impact. They just are. And not just the generations that maybe descend through us, if we have kids and grandkids and all of those things, but also the generations of people that come from all the people that are connected to our lives that we impact. It's like taking a rock, and you've heard this illustration, and throwing it out into the middle of a like glass smooth pond, right? And it hits in the middle of the pond and it makes a little splash. And then what happens? All the way through the pond, the ripples of that splash, that rock hitting the water, go all the way to the edges of the pond. The problem is the pond that we're talking about has no edges. It goes on into eternity. So me coming to God and demanding that he explain himself to me is ridiculous, logically. But boy, do I ever want him to do it sometimes. That's reasonable too, and he knows that. So what he offers us is the best possible thing that he can offer us. He offers us himself. Like, if you've got something higher or better or more helpful than that, what is it? He's like, listen, I'm going to come, I'm going to offer you me, and I'm going to offer you my forgiveness. I'm going to offer you my love and relationship. I'm going to offer you my life-giving spirit and presence in your life. I'm going to offer you my voice as you learn how to follow it and listen to it through my word and in other means. I'm offering you my grace, my mercy, my comfort, my strength, my power, my joy, my perspective as I reveal things to you as you move through life. I'm offering you me. It's like he comes to us in the dark, because that's where we are when we're trying to make sense of things. It's like, yeah, no, I got nothing. Like, I can't, you know. And he's just like, he offers us his hand in the dark and says, will you take it? Because darkness is as light to me. It is not dark in this room for me, but it is for you. And I will lead you through this season out of the dark into the light and through the rest of your life if you'll have me. And by the way, when need be, I'll even carry you. He offers us himself. And what Joseph is teaching us week by week, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, word by word in the record of his life is that that, guys, is enough. It's more than enough. Beloved and favored by his dad, Jacob, Joseph's hated by his brothers. And not just because of the favoritism, because of his dreams. The dreams are enormously significant to this entirety of this story. When he's 17, he has two dreams, not one, but they just have one message. Hang on to that. And in the dreams, it's awesome if you're him. He's standing, his brothers are all bowing at his feet, and that's where his brothers are like, we're out. We can handle the favoritism, barely. The multicolored coat dad gave him, okay, fine. He's going to be the primary heir and the leader of the family, even though he's got 10 older brothers. Like, we can stomach all of that and just be nasty to him all the way through life. That's okay. But when you're telling us, or really when God's telling us, that we're going to bow at the feet of that kid, not happening. And so they seize the first opportunity that they get. They kidnap Joseph. They strip him of his multicolored coat. They sell him to some spice traders as a slave who are heading down to Egypt, who then take him down to Egypt and then sell him for a profit as a slave to a man named Potiphar. Potiphar's really significant. Potiphar is the captain of the guard of Pharaoh. Potiphar's in charge of the entire prison system. Potiphar is the guy who handles all the executions. Potiphar is a wealthy high official in Pharaoh's government, and his house is in all likelihood located in an administrative complex of houses and dwellings and offices that are all attached to the palace. He's kind of the man. And he buys Joseph, and he brings him home. And at no time do we read, and in this moment, because it's super confusing to Joseph, because, I mean, you know, God had told him his brothers are going to be bowing at his feet and he's going to be standing, but now his brothers are living in a different country, and like, he's a slave in Egypt, for crying out loud. P.S. they were going to murder him, and then they alternatively said, nah, we'll just sell him and make some money. Like, what are the odds of them ever kneeling at this guy's feet? Like, it's never going to happen. So he thinks. And at no time in the midst of this confusion do we read that God then shows up and says, hey, dude, let me explain this to you. It looks like this. This is the picture. This is what's happening. Now do you get it? Relax. It's going to be about 20 years before this happens. But nevertheless, It just says, and the Lord was with Joseph in the house of Potiphar. And he prospered everything he touched. And Potiphar, who is a bright man, realized this guy, man, he's got everything he touches turns to gold. So he changes the whole organizational chart for Potiphar Incorporated, and now it's Potiphar, and then it's Joseph, and then it's everyone else. And let me qualify this: for a slave who's been rejected by his brothers, hated and, you know, sold into slavery, and all, who now lives in Egypt, who's had to learn a new language, and everything is upside down for that guy in those circumstances in that moment, I mean, it was about as good as it's going to get. Things seem to be kind of, you know, balancing out, smoothing out. It's like, oh, Joseph can breathe again. Until enters Mrs. Potiphar. And Mrs. Potiphar takes a liking to Joseph, and he turns her down, and she comes again. He's like, no, and she comes again. He's like, no, and again, and no, and again, and no. And finally he sits her down. He's like, hey, listen, this is never going to happen. So let's just be super clear about this. And now she turns on him, and she hates him. And she creates a situation in which it's just he and her in the house, and then she screams and charges him with attempted rape, which of course he did not do. And Potiphar comes home to this whole mess, and what does he do? Because he's the chief executioner. Does he execute Joseph? Because it seems like that would be the message you'd want to send. He doesn't, curious. I mean, we don't know. We don't have him on interview. You know, he can't look up Potiphar on YouTube and say, hey, why didn't you kill Joseph? But it seems like he doesn't do it because he has some doubts about her story. But he also doesn't have a videotape or a witness. So he says to Joseph, look, dude, here's the thing. I have some doubts about this story. Nevertheless, I've got to do something here. So you can no longer serve me as chief of Potiphar Incorporated above ground, but you can do it below the ground. In other words, I'm going to take you, I'm in charge of the prison system, remember? And I'm going to put you as the chief administrator, also, by the way, a prisoner, in the underground dungeon of Pharaoh's prison, where you, by the way, are not going to see the light of day for years and years and years and years. And what we don't read in that moment is that the Lord showed up and said, look, I know it just seems like it's just getting harder and harder that these dreams are ever going to happen. And I know this is super painful and your vitamin D levels are tanking because you got no sunlight, like that's depressing, like check that for yourself. But anyway, like, so let me explain it. Give me your puzzle. And he doesn't do that. But we do read the Lord is with Joseph and prospers him there too. And one day, while he is governing over, well, the underground dungeon, two very, very important prisoners enter into the prison that he's running, the chief cupbearer of Pharaoh and the chief baker of Pharaoh. And here's the deal. Don't think about these guys as like the chief caterers. You know, oh, yeah, you're the guy that pours the wine, and you're the dude that makes the sandwiches. Like, that's not it. I mean, that they govern over the food of Pharaoh. But think about that for a second, because the most common way to execute somebody or to assassinate somebody who is a political leader in that day was poisoning. These guys are highly intelligent, very well educated, extremely powerful, hugely influential, some of the most intimate, closest, trusted advisors of Pharaoh. And yes, the guy would taste the wine beforehand. I mean, this is, he's placing his life in the cupbearer's hand and his life in the baker's hands. You get the point? Like, these guys on the same day put in prison? Oh, wow. What in the world happened? And we actually don't know what happened. We just know that now Joseph's, you know, like tending to them because they're in his prison. And one day he's walking down the hallway, I suppose, and he sees them sitting in their cell and he can tell that they're dejected. And he's like, guys, what's going on? What gives here? Because this seems unusual for the two of you. And they're like, well, so here's the deal. Last night we both had a dream that some God gave us. And we are absolutely positive that some God gave us these dreams. Each a different dream, one for the two of us, okay? And here's the deal. If we were not stuck down here in this pit with you, but we had our former positions, we would have access to all these different people who interpret dreams, and we could bring them all in, and we could gain an interpretation for this dream. And here's the thing. Like, we're pretty convinced that these dreams foretell our future, and given the fact that we're in this prison kind of waiting for Pharaoh to figure out what he's going to do with us, like, we'd really like to know what the plan is, because we're nervous. So how cruel is it for whatever God this is that's given us these dreams to give us these dreams and no one to interpret them? So now we're like, oh, well, thanks. Appreciate that. And listen to what Joseph says and consider what the implications of this are. It's profound. Genesis 40, verse 8, he says to these guys, he says, do not interpretations belong to God? What God? Well, certainly not Pharaoh, who's worshipped as a god. Not any of the Egyptian gods. He's talking about his God, the one true living God, the God, as we would say, of the Bible. He's like, do not interpretations belong? I know it's hard for you guys to believe this because, I mean, I, you know, got here first and I'm a prisoner and all. To my God, he's saying. And then he says, please tell me what your dreams are. Tell your dreams to me. What is he revealing in that moment? He's going all the way back to his dreams, and he's telling you that notwithstanding the fact that it's now been 11 years since God gave him those two dreams with one message, in which his brothers are bowing and he's standing, and notwithstanding the fact that literally everything that's happened in this man's life in those 11 years, seemingly at least, have moved him farther and farther and farther and farther away from those dreams ever becoming a reality, he still believes that A, God is the giver of these kinds of dreams, and B, he actually has the gift to interpret it and that God will reveal these things. He thinks he's accurately interpreted. He's saying, my brothers are still going to bow at my feet. I have no idea how. Don't know when. Can't even begin to imagine it. Which takes a tremendous amount of faith, doesn't it? Because we look at our little puzzle piece and then we judge God because we can't imagine how anything good could ever come of this. We're underselling him and we're overselling us. So Joseph's like, guys, I'm here. I got a little time. Let's go. So they each tell Joseph their dream. And then he says, well, all right, so here's the interpretation. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Cupbaker. I've got good news and I have bad news. The bad news is just coming for you, Mr. Baker. We're going to get to you in a second. We'll start with the good news. The good news for you, Mr. Cupbearer, is that in 3 days' time, you're going to be forgiven of all of your sins. Whatever it is that you've done, Pharaoh's going to erase it, and you're going to be restored to your position at the right hand of Pharaoh. Amazing. Good for you. Mr. Cupbearer, you might want to have a seat. Or Mr. Baker, you might want to sit down, right? He's getting out the smelling salts. He's like, what your dream means is that in 3 days' time, Pharaoh's going to cut off your head. He's going to impale your body on a pole. And then he's going to just leave it there until the birds of the air, the scavenger birds, come and eat away at your flesh, which is devastating for so many reasons, not the least of which is that he's not only being denied life that he has that's physical, but he's being denied, at least according to the Egyptian, you know, cult of the dead, the afterlife. Why? Why do they have mummies in Egypt, guys? Because you have to preserve the physical body according to their theology of the afterlife in order to gain the afterlife. So Pharaoh is not just going to deny him of the life that he's living now, he's going to deny him eternity. That's a moment. So Joseph then grabs the cupbearer by the elbow and he's like, listen, let's give our friend a moment. I can see that he needs to work this through. I'd like to have a conversation with you in the hallway. And he takes him out into the hallway and he has what I think is one of his rare moments of weakness. Like you read through the life of Joseph, honestly, he's like, he's almost perfect. I know that he's not perfect. Jesus alone is perfect. Hear that. But the record of his life is so remarkable. I mean, you know, there are a couple of things that maybe you can question. Like you can question the wisdom of whether or not he should have shared with his brothers that he had dreams in which he's standing and they're all bowing, knowing that they already hate and resent him. Like you go, you know, maybe not one of your finer moments. But on the other hand, you can argue that, wait a second, he's been entrusted with a download of the revelation of God. Is that to be kept to yourself? I don't know. I mean, you get later in the story than where we're at presently, and you see Joseph, and he takes and he enslaves the entirety of the land to Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh has all the food, guys. And what will you give in exchange for food which equals life in the midst of a famine? All you have. And he collects it all up. And here's the deal. In the next generation, his people are enslaved by the Egyptians. And you think, huh, is there a relationship between those two things? And it seems to me that there is. And so you wonder, was that wise? But outside of that, you just have this moment, in my opinion. And in this moment, it seems that what he's doing is he's looking to a man to do for him what only God can do. And I say that because he pulls this guy out into the hallway and he's like, okay, so here's the deal. I'm not supposed to be here, which every criminal says, right? Can we just say that? Like, yeah, I didn't, I robbed the bank, but I shouldn't be, you know, like, stop, you know, just, but in his case, it's true. And he relates his stories like my brothers and this is what, and how I got here and I'm sold. And then I, Potiphar's wife, I mean, you know, you've heard the rumors about her reputation. Let me just say that it's true. And you know, so then, here I am and you're about to be elevated back to this position of authority, right hand of Pharaoh. You've got his ear. You're one of the most powerful people in Egypt, which means in all the world to some degree, like you are the man. And then he says, remember me when you're restored. And the word remember is a covenantal term that's otherwise just applied to the Lord. The idea being that it's the kind of remembering and salvation that only God can bring. So again, it seems like maybe he fractures a bit. I can totally understand it. Not saying I wouldn't have done it. But it seems like maybe he's looking to this guy to do for him what only the Lord can do for him. And that's a problem. And God has huge plans for Joseph. The whole bowing, standing, it's all coming. I mean, he has no idea where this thing is going. He'll find out today. But it's big. And so God causes, and this is painful, the cupbearer to forget him for 2 years. He's thinking, you know, this guy gets out in 3 days. On day four, I'm out. No. He forgets about you entirely. And he forgets about him until any hope that man could bring the kind of salvation, the kind of deliverance, can do for him the kinds of things that only God can do for him, dies in him. And he begins to look to the Lord alone to do the kinds of things that the Bible comes to us and says, and by the way, experience authenticates, you know, only God can do this for you. And look, we do this all the time. You know, we look, for example, to our parents to give us the kind of love that only God can give to us. And I say that saying parental love, by the way, massive. It's huge. I can't give you a bigger one, earthly speaking. I mean, you know, we've got kids. I love our kids. We have in-law kids now. I love our in-law kids. We have grandkids. I played the fool for like 3 hours yesterday, running from an invisible dinosaur and letting this three-year-old catch me like 5,000 times. I'm actually a little sore right now. Like, and it was the delight, was the best thing I did all week. It's amazing. Love these kids. All of them. It's incredible. But God has fashioned our hearts to be satisfied only in him, to be filled only by him. And so when there's an infinite space inside of me and inside of you, and we look to somebody else to fill it, be that a parent, be that a spouse, be that a child, you name it, we're dissatisfied. And they're frustrated because they feel like they're perennial failures. It's glorious. Like you get married and you're like, you are going to satisfy the deepest longings of my soul. And they're like, and you are going to satisfy the deepest longings of my soul. And you know, it's no wonder we have issues. It's not going to happen. But what if instead God satisfied the deepest longings of our souls, and whether or not we're receiving what we would like to receive, we're full and in a position to give. It's different. We've got this hole in our heart that says, you want to be significant, you want to be valuable, and we chase and we try to fill it ourselves. We try to fill it with achievement and academics and athletics and, you know, money and all of these other things, and, you know, with this, by other people. And, you know, this is nice, but it's not going to do it. It's never enough, ever, because the hole is huge. It's infinite. And God's like, you know, I gave my infinitely valuable son so that you might be my son or daughter. That alone communicates an infinite amount of value. It alone fills the heart. So Joseph is forgotten by the cupbearer, but not by God. And 2 years later, God then sends Pharaoh 2 dreams with 1 message. Sound familiar? Joseph, 2 dreams, 1 message. Cupbearer, baker, 2 dreams. Different messages. But now Pharaoh, 2 dreams, 1 message. He calls in all of his advisors, all his counselors, all his wise men. Nobody can interpret the dreams. He is super frustrated and agitated, and as a result, so is everyone else. Like, who else is now going to go to prison because we can't interpret these dreams? It's an unnerving kind of situation, okay? And all of a sudden, the cupbearer has this aha moment. He's like, wait a second. There's one person we haven't consulted. I know he's in jail, but we've heard about Potiphar's wife, and even Potiphar's like, yes, I don't know. You know, like, I think he's the guy. I had a dream. The baker had a dream. He interpreted the dreams. Exactly what he said would happen is exactly what Pharaoh, you did, actually. So they call Joseph up out of the pit into the palace, and he comes before Pharaoh. And you can imagine how unnerving this is. Like, this is like one of the most powerful men in the world, you know? This is the first time I've seen sunlight. He's like, you know, in a while. And Pharaoh says, I understand that you have the ability to interpret dreams. And notice what he says and what he doesn't. Chapter 41, verse 16, it says that Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. What a man. He says, but God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. I mean, literally, it means an answer that will bring him peace, and with him, everybody else. But notice what he's not doing. I mean, it's very opportunistic, but not at all opportunistic for Joseph. Like, opportunistic for Joseph would be, you darn right I can do this, and I notice that nobody else can. Surely I would be of more benefit to you up here than down there in the pit. I mean, come on, Pharaoh, you know what? Let's work a deal. I'll answer this for you if you'll do. No, none of that. He's opportunistic for God. Pharaoh, who does not ask about his God, who is himself worshipped as a God, who worships a whole pantheon of gods, gets told by Joseph, without request, about his God. And he's like, yeah, let me know the dreams, because God's going to answer. And he'll answer through me, but it's him. Just know that he's the one doing it. And so Pharaoh tells Joseph his dreams. And Joseph says, okay, so here's what this means. It means that you are about to enter, really, we as a nation, into the most profitable season the next 7 years, agriculturally, than we've ever seen. Like, nothing like it. It's going to be unbelievably full of abundance. However, at the end of that 7 years, we're going to enter into 7 years of a famine, the severity of which has never been seen in this land. And at that point, you can hear a pin drop in that room, because the deal is, guys, like, you know, if you're going to survive a year of famine, all right, I think we can make it through. If you're going to go 2 years of famine, we're losing. We're losing a lot of animals and people, right? You get to 3 years of famine, this is a full-blown five-alarm fire. Like, we are in 7 years of famine, the kingdom's done. It's over. There's nobody to govern. There's nothing. Like, go find somewhere else to live. Everybody out. Like, this is what, I mean, this is absolutely devastating. And now Joseph, who's only been asked about the dream, kind of steps up and says, I know you haven't asked me what I think you should do, but I am sort of an administrative genius. I mean, ask Potiphar. He's in the back of the room. Like, Potiphar's like, double thumbs up. He's like, let me tell you what I think ought to happen. Just casting this out there for your consideration. Do with it what you want. And I want to read this part to you, because this is the part where Joseph's little puzzle piece is starting, not completely, but it is really starting to find its place in God's big picture. Like, things are getting connected for him, where he's going, oh, this is what this has all been about all this time. Verse 33 says, now therefore, this is Joseph speaking, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man. Now, who do you think is campaigning for the job? Like, he's like, nobody else was able to answer this. Maybe I'm that guy. And set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land. Regionally is the idea. And take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. He's like, 20% of these plentiful years, because the years will be so plentiful, will be enough to carry us all the way through the famine. He says, and let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and store up grain under whose authority? Under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them, meaning Pharaoh and his soldiers, keep it. And Pharaoh is beginning to connect the dots now, don't you think? Food equals life. After the 7 years of abundance, he'll be in charge of dispensing life, or not. And what will people give you in return for their life? about everything they have. So all of a sudden, this devastating prophecy of, hey, we're going to all be dead in, you know, 7 years, it's not going to be a kingdom. He's thinking at the end of the 7 years, not only will we survive, I'll own literally everything and everyone. This is a good business proposition for him. He says that the food may be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. And then we read this, and only the remembering of the Lord can bring this. It says, this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. They're all like, yeah, that's what we ought to do. And Pharaoh said to his servants, and I think it's rhetorical, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? He's like, we can't, right? I mean, can we all agree? They're all like, yep, nope, nobody. I think we've proven that. And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all of this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. And even though I just, I mean, to be honest, called you up out of prison, and I mean, presumably you're a criminal. I haven't really checked any references, but Potiphar's been, you know, giving me the from the back of the room. And so like, I'm just, oh, what the heck? You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have just set you over all the land of Egypt. Wow. That's what you call a good day at the office, man. It's incredible. I was in the dungeon, and now I'm the prime minister of Egypt. I got one boss, him, but he's like, no, just do whatever you want. Like, you're the guy. Like you. And so what does Joseph do? He takes the job, right? He's like, I'm going to do this. I'm very excited. I'm super honored. But then he's like, but first I've got to, you know, mete out a little vengeance of my own, if you don't mind. Like, my first act as prime minister is I'm going to dispatch some soldiers to the land of Canaan. I'm going to give a very good description of my brothers, and I want them to bring them all back here. Tell them, by the way, to bring their toothbrushes, because there are going to be a lot of toilets to scrub where they're going to be living out the rest of their days. And by the way, Potiphar, I'm hopeful that we can both agree that this is going to be good for you and for me. Your wife is going to join them. And by the way, chief cupbearer, put the cup down. You're next. Now that I've gotten that taken care of, let's get on with the rest of the... He doesn't do that. Why doesn't he do that? I mean, look, there are a lot of reasons, okay? I think the most profound reason why it is that we should forgive other people is because we've come into contact with God and he has forgiven us. And it is like an infinite debt that he has paid for us in Christ. Nobody owes me an infinite debt. No one. No one. And no one ever will. I'm just not that big of a deal, but God is. And so when my infinite debt has been paid at the expense of the infinitely valuable life of Christ for me, and that's what God has done in order to extend forgiveness to me, it's like that. If that's hit my heart at all, I have to become a more forgiving person, don't I? But also for Joseph, he's starting to connect the dots. Like, he's able immediately, because he's incredibly brilliant, to just see how it all falls together. He's like, oh, wait a minute. So this is why my brothers picked on me all the way. And this is why they did this evil, awful thing. And this is why I was sold into slavery. And this is why I'm down here. And this is why Potiphar's wife, you know, like, did this. And she falls away. And this is why Potiphar kept me alive, by the way. Thank you, Potiphar, in the back. You get a raise. And you know, like, and this is why I was in the prison and why I was there for so long. And this is why these guys came in. And then they had the dreams. And then they forgot me. And I can even see why that happened, because it had to time out this way, and I had to let my trust in man die. And God is a genius. And all of these things that I could never see, if all I could look at is this, I can suddenly see. And that makes me gracious. Perhaps even grateful in a very odd, ironic, and oftentimes difficult way for the evil, awful, painful things that I've had to endure. He gets a glimpse as to what God's up to. And so it's like he's got this backpack, you know, full of like hurt and hate and resentment, anger, and all of the frustration and disappointment. I mean, put the words in there. And he's able to just sort of like peel it off and put it at the feet of Jesus and go, oh, I can breathe. I don't actually have to carry that. And why is this story in the Bible? Well, the story's in the Bible in part so that you can do the same thing before you get to see how your puzzle piece fits into the puzzle. Like, you don't have to wait until you die and go to heaven and the whole of, you know, humanity and the world history wraps up to do this. God's like, no, 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 you can see what I'm like. You can trust that I'm working behind the scenes, outside the edges of your puzzle, in a way that you can't see, but that somehow makes sense of it all. And in that, you can take the backpack off now in faith. Look at Joseph's story. It tells you how I work. And man, is there freedom found in that. There's a lot of release of poison. That's just poisoning, by the way, us. So Joseph doesn't throw himself into the mission of revenge. He throws himself into the mission of saving people, which, by the way, is why this story speaks not just to people in dungeons, but people in palaces. He occupies both in the space of one day. He takes all of his newfound fame and all of his newfound prestige and power and wealth and might and all of the things that now belong to him, 100%. It's amazing. And he throws it all into the mission of saving people, which, as an aside, is our mission as well. It is our mission to take the life-saving message of Jesus to people and to share that with people that they might be forgiven and brought into the family of God. It's the offer of God. It's free. All you have to do is receive it. It's remarkable. But we bring physical salvation in some senses as well at times. And it's amazing how those things relate. I remember years ago, we had an older gentleman who's now long been in heaven, and his name was Leo Pacheco. I don't know how many of you guys remember Leo, but Leo was actually a World War II veteran, okay? He was a guy that was a Navy sailor, and he was a cook on a Navy ship during World War II. And then when the war ended, one of the generals, I guess, liked his food so much that he put him on his staff, and then he got to stay in Europe for a while this general had some extended duties over there. But then when he came home, he became a truck driver. So he was a sailor in the Navy, and then he was a truck driver all of his incredibly long life. So his language was, shall I say, colorful and descriptive. He was a wonderful guy, but you know, there was not a lot of filter. And so anyway, one time he came to faith, he grew up Catholic, and he gave his life to Christ here. And one time he came late, which I didn't even notice, you know, but he used to sit right over here. And he came up to me after the service, and he's like, Tom, and he was embarrassed. Like, he was like, you know, blushing. He's like, I'm so sorry. I apologize that I was late. I'm like, dude, look around. Like, nobody's here when we start, so sorry. You're welcome. But no, you're the only one who's saying he's sorry. So he's like, no, I'm sorry. I was late. He's like, my truck, you know, I had a flat, and I had to pull over on the side of the road and to change my flat. Meanwhile, he's 88. And I'm picturing this guy in this heat changing a tire on the side of Federal Highway. And I said, well, tell me about your truck, Leo. And he started to tell me. And so what I discovered is that his truck had 4 bald tires plus 3 bald tires in the bed of the truck so that one of the tires, when it went flat, he could just trade it out for another bald tire. And I said, all right, so let's do this. Tomorrow, you got some time? You know, he's like, yeah, I mean, you know, I got nothing to do. I'm like, all right, cool. So you're going to come by the church, and this man named Ken Nordstrom is going to meet you in the office, and Ken's going to come out, and he's going to inspect your truck. And then we're going to take your truck. I mean, if you're okay with this, and we're going to send it over to this place, Wilt Manors, that we use, and they, you know, they work with us on these kinds of things, and we're going to put all new tires on your truck. We're going to give you a spare. And by the way, Leo, like, if anything else is broken, meanwhile, I'm going, oh, you know, like, we're going to fix that too. So if you need a brake job, we're going to do that. If you need an oil change, he's like, I haven't changed the oil. It's hard for me to get under it. I'm like, you shouldn't be getting under it. You're 88, you know, but I mean, you know, he's been a truck driver all his life. It's what you do, right? He's like, I can fix stuff. I'm like, relax, you know, new windshield wipers, like, well, any, whatever needs to be fixed, we're just going to do it. And he's this salty dude. So he's just standing there and I can see him processing this. Like, is this real, you know? And then he starts getting red in the face, and he just bursts out in tears. Snot, you know, like, I mean, he's just straight up blubbering, this tough old man. And he's like, thank you, thank you. He's like hugging me, thank you, Tom. And I said, well, I said, let's be clear on this. Tom is not the one doing it. The Lord has given to us, and we've set it aside to help people. And you're one of his people. So it means that he's been getting ready for you. So Leo, what that means is he knows who you are, he knows where you're at, he knows what your needs are, and before you even showed up with him, he had already made provision. And that just changed this. I mean, it blew his mind that God would know him and love him in that way. You have the opportunity to do things like that, guys. We're on a mission, or we're supposed to be. And the mission is tell people about Jesus and live it out in front of them and take the resources or the gifts or the talents or whatever it is that we, you know, if I was a mechanic, I could have said, bring it over to my house, I'll fix it for you, like whatever. And put them at his service. And have the joy of seeing what he does with it. It's nothing short of awesome. So it becomes the best part of your week, you know, and then you get like addicted to it. Like now I got to do this all the time. All the other stuff I do so I can do this. Joseph stores up food for 7 years. The famine hits. We'll see it next week. But let me ask you this before we're done. Who in your life are you trying to get something out of that only God can give to you? And be careful, you might be sitting next to them, okay? I ask you that because that is a prison, both for you and for them. You'll be perpetually dissatisfied and they will perpetually feel like they're failing. Doesn't sound like a win-win. Come to Christ. Let him fill your heart. Believe for a change that it's an infinite hole that needs to be filled by an infinite God, and learn from a place of fullness to give and not to have to receive all the time. It changes you from a getter to a giver. Secondly, what hurt or anger or resentment do you need to just take off, you know, the backpack? Like, I have carried this stupid thing around since I was 6, you know, like, no, I don't need to do that. I still don't understand it, but I can trust that somehow outside the edges, God is making sense of this. What hurt or anger or resentment do you need to take off and place at the feet of Jesus, trusting that God can and will use everything that has happened, everything that is happening, and everything that yet happens to you in this life for good? And by everything, I mean everything. All of it. God is that big. And then thirdly, who do you need to extend grace and forgiveness to? Because you've been forgiven, I mean, if you're a Christian, of an infinite debt. And if you can trust that God is actually going to make sense of all this stuff, you don't have to exact the vengeance on your own, do you? You can just kind of let that all go. And then finally, what place does the mission of God occupy in your life? Super easy to figure out. How do you use your time? Because time is life. How do you use the gifts and talents that God has entrusted to you? What do you do with your resources and your money? Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's not a lie. Like, that's a fact. How do you use yourself? You. What do you do? What are you willing to risk and venture in regard to your reputation? Well, I don't want them to think I'm weird if I invite them to Alpha. Yeah, we got to get over that. Let them think you're weird if that's what's going to happen. But I doubt it will, to be honest. What are you willing to do? What place does the mission of God occupy in your life, because there's great joy waiting for you as you get to be used of the Holy Spirit to just take people, and this is all this is, to take people and introduce them to Jesus and get out of the way. It's beautiful. And I want that for you, okay? All right, let me pray.